Heading into winter of 2025-2026, Vladimir Putin appears poised to try and launch a knockout blow against the Ukrainian energy system, leaving them not only dark and with not enough electricity to run their industry and their economy, but also potentially the heating and everything else needed to just exist in potentially a harsh winter that's coming up here. They haven't been that bad in the last 2 years. Russia has been trying to do this a bit each of the last two winters ahead of before, but this time it's with a renewed sense of vigor and definitely at a larger scale. And the results are seeming to expand, and there's more of these missiles and drones that are striking their targets, causing significant cumulative damage throughout the Ukraine side. And we're going to try and assess what that means and what else is going on, both in the air and on the ground in the Russia-Ukraine war. And to analyze that, we have back with us today Matthew Ho, a big treat for us. Second time in a week we've been able to get you on. So we're pretty thrilled about that. Matthew Ho is a senior fellow at the Eisenhower Media Network, and you can follow him on an X at Matt Ho, Matt P. Ho, there you see on the screen. But be sure and follow him on there. Matt, welcome to the show again. Great to have you back.
Hi, Danny. It's good to see you.
Although it's hard to be talking about how good it is to have you back when we have this, you know, awful scenes, burning buildings next to you, et cetera. But, you know, what is just your kind of off the cuff view here? Because, I mean, these are bigger things. This just a couple of days ago, similar things were carried out on the Ukraine side in Odessa and several other cities that have been hitting. Kharkiv has even hitting really plastered here lately. Now Kiev, on the Ukraine side, they've actually, at least for a period of time, in one of the southern Russian cities, Bryansk, I believe it was, knocked out their thermal power plant for a period of time and plunged them into darkness. But what do you make of this whole energy infrastructure war?
I think this is the natural progression of it. We've seen this before. We've seen attacks on infrastructure, particularly energy infrastructure, over the last two falls, at least. I can't remember if they did it. They did. The Russians attacked the energy infrastructure in 22, following the American-Ukrainian destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline. You know, of course, itself, the most significant attack on energy infrastructure so far in this war. So I think what we've seen, though, is an expansion of it. We've seen certainly an escalation of not just the rhetoric or the intentions, but the actual carrying out of these operations to be significant. Whereas the, say, the Russian strikes on Ukrainian infrastructure in 22 or 23 were significant, no doubt, and caused a great deal of discomfort for the Ukrainians. It wasn't anything that was a challenge that was going to cost the Ukrainians the war effort. But as you see these increased strikes, 500 missiles and drones in a night, and with the capacity of the Russians to replicate that and their willingness to expand the war further into more infrastructure, into more governmental targets, non-military targets, if you will, that has an enormous impact on the Ukrainians. And we could talk about the Russians as well, because the Ukrainian attacks on Russian energy infrastructure and other infrastructure is nothing to disregard either. It's very significant as well. But as you look at, say, the Ukrainian state of things, where the Ukrainians, you know, the IMF just said, look, hey, your budget shortfall, it's not $30 billion, it's $70 billion. You know, and if you don't have, if someone doesn't come in and give you and rescue you, provide you with some form of assistance or loan to fill that void in your budget, you're going to go bust, right? I mean, as well as to the impact on the Ukrainian people, we've seen the shift in public opinion over the last couple of years among Ukrainians in terms for a support for a negotiated end to the war. The most recent public opinion polls I saw were back in July, and that you have more than two-thirds, almost 70%. Of Ukrainians saying that they supported a negotiated end to the war. Whereas if you go back a couple of years prior to that, you have barely a quarter or a third of Ukrainians saying they supported a negotiated end to the war. And the flip side of that as well, the number of Ukrainians who say we're going to fight to the last man here has dropped from 75 or 80% to 20 or 25%. And so attacks like this on the infrastructure, the Ukrainian people are recognizing the real cost. This isn't about like the war weariness, as the Western politicians and pundits and media like to describe it, as if it's some character flaw on a people not to want to continue with a war that they cannot win. On the other side of it, though, for the Russians, these attacks on the energy infrastructure, even though they're are limited in terms of how many drones and missiles the Ukrainians can send into Russia, they are significant as well, too. I mean, you're seeing varied reports of the effect, say, on gasoline supply in Russia. And I know some people say those are exaggerated, but, you know, it's real, though, that they have hit, oil refining capacity in Russia at a key time in the fall. And so Russia's gas supply has been diminished. And so the impact on the Russian people, you know, and this is just an adage, I think.
But yeah, I want to camp out on that for a second, because I think that there is potentially, like your view on this, a difference in the impact and the result of the pressure on the very on the two separate populations, Ukraine and in Russia, where I think, and you just talked about the poll numbers dropping and changing on the Ukraine side, wanting just thing to be over with. On the Russian side, it almost seems like it's having the opposite effect,
right?
That it's stealing their resolve to actually press further. As a matter of fact, we had Gilbert Doctorow on a couple of days ago, and he says, from watching a lot of the Russian media, he said, if anything, they're more angry at Putin for not going harder. Not that they're saying, hey, we want this war to end, but they want to press it forward to a victory. How do you see it?
Yeah, that's one of the great, great, great misunderstandings of many misunderstandings or inaccuracies or, you know, just falsities of this war, is that somehow Putin is one that he is the only decision maker in all of this. I mean, he certainly is at the top. He is, you know, authoritative in you know, many ways. But the fact that there aren't other voices that are important in Russia is ludicrous. And to your point, Danny, and as Gilbert said, you know, when you look at the voices on this in Russia, Putin comes across as a moderate. I mean, the pressure on him, you know, is coming from his right. It's from hardliners. It's from people who are saying, you're not doing enough. You're not being strong enough. You're putting us into a bad position here by not finishing this war sooner, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there is always a consequence to foreign war. There's always is. I mean, like, whether it appears now or appears like in the future in some unforeseen or unexpected manner, there are consequences to foreign wars. But you also have this war being a popular war. And so where I see the danger with this going is the hope that it gives the Europeans and many Americans, that if we keep hammering at this, they look at individual items, right? They look at the trees and not the forest, if you will. So they say, oh, look, we've reduced Russian oil refining capacity by 40% or whatever the number is. Man, they are really going to be hurting. It's a matter of time until their revenues and their government starts dropping. They have to cut services to their people. The people are going to be upset, and then they're going to clamor for the war to end, and then Putin's government is going to fall apart, and then this is how we win this thing. When that is not what's happening, certainly there are parts of the Russian economy that are not doing so well, but there are other parts that are doing very well. One of the things about this war that should, or about this whole episode that should really be noted by the West, is not just the resilience of the Russian economy, but their capacity to expand it, their capacity to build it and grow it, whether it be finding new trading partners or dramatically increasing their trade with other nations, or the fact that, yeah, I mean, if you went back to Russia 2 years ago, 3 years ago, because of the sanctions, there was stuff missing on their store shelves. But you talk to Russians now, people who are there now, they'll tell you, no, we filled it all. We're either importing it from other countries or we're making it ourselves. I mean, so the resilience here of the Russian economy, Russian industry, and the ability of the Russian leadership to plan for this and execute it to ensure that their economy, even as it was under, 19 rounds of sanctions now from the West, something that's supposed to crash the Russian economy, actually you saw the opposite.
Bone-crushing sanctions.
Right. Exactly. You saw the opposite of that, actually. You saw an overheating Russian economy for a few years. And so they had some inflation, and that inflation's going down. But overall, in terms of the health of the Russian economy, their debt to GDP ratio, their revenue, you know, not many years ago, 10 years ago or so, half of Russian government revenue came from oil and gas. And now it's only about 20% or so. It shows how the Russian leadership has been quite effective. Again, not just at ensuring that their economy and their industry is resilient from attacks from the West, but to grow it and expand it and to make it even more powerful. And, you know, and I say this not as someone who is cheerleading for Russia, but as someone who's trying to get Western leaders to understand where they're putting themselves here, what they are confronting. Look, you had the numbers last month of Russian drones that were launched into Ukraine, and I think it was almost 6,000. And then you had the numbers from Ukraine into Russia, and it's about 2,500. It's about the 3.5 years of war. With all the pronouncements from the West, from the Americans and the Europeans about how we are going to give Ukraine everything they need to win this war, and we're going to expand our industrial capacity, we're going to build out our armament factories, et cetera, et cetera. We're going to become a new arsenal for democracy, all the rhetoric that went with it. 3.5 years later, you've got Russia able to send about 2.5 times more drones into Ukraine than Ukraine can send into Russia. Right. I mean, so this is a fight just on the industrial side that the West has demonstrated it can't win, let alone the fact that we know, thanks to that really great story. I mean, it's clear. I mean, if the New York Times publishes something like this, you know, this is where it happens. This is the beauty of having stenographers for the U.S. government like the New York Times. So, right. I mean, so that we know, like, because you and I, we could say 2 years ago, 3 years ago, the American generals are the ones who are waging this war, not the Ukrainian generals. And people are like, okay, yeah, whatever, ho, whatever, Davis. But when the Times, as they did back in March or April this year, published that massive story on how particularly, say, the Ukrainian offensive of 23 was led by American officers in Wiesbaden, Germany. Hey, you know, that's the way it was. You know, if the Times publishes something like that with the full approval of the American government, you know, for whatever reasons why the Pentagon and the White House wanted that information out there, they put it out there. And so we've seen. So it's not only just the fact that we can't win this war because our industry, our economy can't measure up to the Russians. It's also, too, our leadership can't measure up to the Russians.
And on that point, there's something I want to get. Earlier today, I did a whole show on this, and so I won't repeat a lot of that, but I would like your comment on this. There is a piece today published by the Atlantic Council, dispatched from Ukraine. The path to a durable peace is emerging. And in this piece, the author, who is the chief president and CEO of the organization, goes on to say basically that some of the interesting points here, that they, now that we realize that Russia cannot win on the ground, we're looking for some other things here. And they want a just and durable peace. And they define that as everything that's in Zelensky's favor. And it is totally divorced from reality. Doesn't even address the Russian side of this. The only thing that's come close to being talked about here that's a valid is that they talk about the Ukraine drone capacity, which is legitimate and it's powerful, but they don't put it in context. They don't see what the Russians, and they give the impression, if not the outright statement, that Putin can be forced into a peace. What do you say when you see stuff like this?
I think that his phrasing is off the mark. I mean, if he Russia cannot win on the ground, I think is not the right way to describe it. It'd be that Russia cannot lose on the ground. You know, I mean, like
just a slight variation of that. That's right, all. Right,
but I mean, that doesn't mean that Russia could, you know, win. You know, I mean, it's the sense that Russia can't lose and Ukraine can't win. That's the formulation that war has been the entire 3.5 years and will continue that way, where Russia cannot lose and Ukraine cannot win. I mean, we've talked before my view on what would a Russian win look like. You know, what a collapsed Ukrainian government, millions of people who are now refugees, many of them will go into Russia themselves, have already absorbed a million refugees or more. Russia, you know, the eastern part of Ukraine is devastated, it's depopulated, it's deindustrialized because everything's been destroyed. Right? You know, and then now you've got to fit in what across the river from them, you know, even if the Russians move forward and take buffer zones that they've talked about west of the four prime oblasts, what are you talking about? A failed Ukrainian state in the middle of Europe? You're talking about Syria. You're talking about Afghanistan in the middle of Europe. You know what I mean? Like, how is that a win for the Russians just as much as how would that be a you know, a win for anybody? So that's been my view on like the strategic error of the Russians here. Once they didn't achieve what they tried to achieve early on the world war in the first few weeks of the war through forcing a negotiated settlement, which I believe was their objective. Once that occurred, they're now stuck. And so the problem is, I would get back to saying before about, and what I think Kagan is trying to push here, when you're taking the trees and not the forest, when they're taking details, again, Russian oil capacity, oil refining capacity is down 40% or whatever the number is, right? They're taking that and they're running with it. And they're saying, look, this is working. This war is working. As you said, he's pointing to Russia, to Ukraine's expanded drone production capabilities. As you said, very true. It's significant. It causes a lot of difficulties for the Russians on tactical and operational levels. But it's not taken or understood in the overall context of the war. Like, you know, especially what are the Russians doing? You know, how else is their economy behaving? Where does the Russian population see this war? Where is public opinion in Russia on this war? And what type of pressure is being put onto Putin? It's completely the opposite of the way Kagan and others are describing the circumstances. So the danger in all this, of course, is it gives this idea, this fantasy that the war can be won. And I think certainly the war can be continued. I think you run into the danger of Ukraine collapsing, whether it be a military collapse or a civilian government economy collapse. And I put, I put equal money on which one would come first, and so there's that danger. But I think that the Europeans and many Americans view this as, well, look, we've done it before. As long as we keep the fire hose, as long as the money keeps going in, the balloon will stay inflated. And if we can just get the Ukrainians to lower their draft age, right, and start recruiting 18 and 19 and 20 year olds, then they'll have another half generation to put into this war. We could keep the balloon inflated. We can, you know, like that crazy armed balloon you see outside of car dealerships, right? You can keep that thing upright and wiggling around and dancing. I mean, that's basically what they believe they can accomplish here. And then they hope for some, deus ex machina, they hope for something that Putin has a stroke or something like that, or that a coup does occur or something, even though, as we've discussed, if that was to happen, the results would be the opposite in terms of who will come into power. Right.
I want to go back to something you said just a second ago, to see if you can give a little bit more depth on what you intend by that, because you said that Russia basically can't get a real win because they're stuck strategically and that they would have a failed state on their border. But in a certain sense, wouldn't that be a victory for the Russian side, because they have a quasi state that's defunct and that can no longer pose a threat to them? And that might even be a positive thing from Russia.
It could be. But I think the risk, though, of having a failed state with all those weapons, with essentially warlords, you know, with who in Ukraine over the last years, what group has performed best politically in terms of actually getting hold of power, putting themselves in positions of power, right? It's the right wing in Ukraine. It's the Nazis that the Russians complain about and are afraid about. They're the ones in the best positions now. So if you had a fractured state, a failed state, those who would benefit most would be those who are still the most hostile to the Russians. And it just would be an ugly, awful mess that be the, you know, the opposite of the stability that I think anybody wants to see there, including the Russians. I mean, certainly they'd have to then garrison. And I, because I don't think this was their objective, say almost four years ago, was to have to garrison that eastern part of Ukraine and essentially be in this position where they are now the dream of every aspiring American and European general is to be the general who takes back the Donbass, right? To be the Richard the Lionheart of, you know, the modern age, right? That the Donbass is now the new Jerusalem that we have to take back. You know, so I think they put themselves, they have put themselves into that position. Same time too, weighing everything else, you know, it's easy for me to say that sitting here. I'm not the one who's concerned with their national security matters as they are. So I can understand why they made that decision. I'll criticize it, but I also understand why they felt like that was the best option for them. But, you know, I mean, certainly, you know, there's no way I see without a negotiated settlement. And through a negotiated settlement, I feel that the Russians can be victorious, right? That through a negotiated settlement where they do achieve that degree of Ukrainian neutrality, which would actually lead to a stabilized Europe militarily, just as Finnish neutrality and Austrian neutrality did, you know, following World War II. So I think there's that possibility. Getting to a negotiated settlement, as you know, we both know now at this point, you know, the road to that is looking really bad. You know,
it is. So, and right. You mentioned people looking back and kind of hearkening back to history. Well, as it turns out, Vladimir Putin did that very thing today at the CIS, Commonwealth of Independent States, when he made a comment connecting his current military to Peter the Great.
I think it's also clear, because it was Peter the Great who laid the foundations of the modern Russian state, whatever its name, the Russian Empire, the Soviet Union. But it was Peter the Great who laid the foundations, the fundamental foundations. Our military as a whole, both our commanders and our soldiers and officers on the ground, essentially defend what Peter the Great created. And then his successors strengthened him. Russia's fate has unfolded differently over time. It has grown. Under Catherine the Great, it even has a tomb right next to Peter the Great. In fact, Russia made the greatest territorial acquisitions, as is well known. So, we paid tribute to those people who made a unique, fundamental contribution to the development of our state. Well, and then I simply held a meeting with my military colleagues, and they reported to me on the situation on each sector of the front, each one for which they are specifically responsible.
So what message do you think, if any, that was intended for? And we'll look at two different audiences. One is the domestic audience, and number two is the European audience, because he's saying, look, we had all these territorial conquests under Peter the Great, under Catherine, and now then here's my current military, and we are advancing both on the ground and in the air. What do you think?
Well, I think, you know, domestically, it's a great recruiting speech, right? It harkens to your forefathers. It harkens to your ancestors. It harkens to those who built and established Russia, who's defended it over the centuries. You know, I think that helps drive, along with their very large bonuses and pay packages for their soldiers, you know, a Russian military that is not facing any manpower difficulties that I'm aware of, right? It's doing quite well that way.
Right.
You know, 3.5 years into the war, you could call it a foreign war. I call it that. I know many Russians don't view it that way. You know, you'd expect maybe the army to be slowing down a bit in terms of how many people were pulling in. And no, they've been expanding it. You know, and then for the Europeans, I think it's the same type of usage of history that we've seen Vladimir Putin use before. You know, just trying to be reasonable with the Europeans in the sense of recall your past, recall your experiences, you know, recall what has happened in, you know, in terms of previous wars, how well they've gone, how well they've failed, you know, how far they failed to advance, how they ultimately did fail, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We can point to, you know, a half dozen examples, you know, and trying just to use that type of historical example that that Putin is saying, it's just not my, it's just not the strength of my army. It's just not the strength of our economy. It's the resilience and the spirit of our people here that has always existed for the Russian people. And I think that's what he's trying to get across to the Europeans. The Europeans, of course, don't seem interested in listening to anyone. You know, I mean,
the message definitely fallen on deaf ears, but they keep giving the message. And as a matter of fact, earlier this week, speaking of the military, you had Valery Gerasimov, the commander of the Russian armed forces, also gave an update to Putin on the front lines.
The enemy has concentrated its main efforts on stabilizing the situation in crisis areas of the front in order to slow down our advance. The North troop grouping is operating along the border zone and continues to carry out tasks to create a security belt in the Kharkiv and Sumy regions of Ukraine. Its units are also successfully advancing in the southern part of Volchansk. The West grouping is completing the rout of the enemy in the southern districts of Kupiansk, successfully advancing in the Krasno-Liman direction, and the liberation of the settlement of Yampol continues, most of which is under our forces' control. The troops of the southern grouping, despite the enemy's stubborn resistance, are advancing through fierce fighting in the cities of Seversk and Konstantinovka.
And by the way, for all those who may have wondered, Gerasimov was not suddenly speaking English. That is AI translation, which has remarkable technological capabilities where they actually change the movements of his mouth to match the English words. Pretty remarkable stuff there. But the bigger issue there, look, he's not wrong. And when you take a look at the current battle map of today, I mean, you see the stuff that he's saying there, it's valid. It's on the map. I mean, it continues to move to the west. Ukraine continues to lose men. Unlike the Russians, which you just pointed out, they don't have a pipeline, no matter stealing people off the ground or troops or money, anything else, which they do try some of that. They don't have enough manpower. So whether you're talking about in the air that we started off here or on the ground, I don't see any path to continue having this fantasy like the Atlantic Council did, that there's going to be some positive outcome for the Ukraine side.
No. I mean, best case for the Ukrainians is that they're able to hold on again because of the infusion of money and armaments from the West, and those are both doubtful. You know, I'm trying to understand the discussions in Brussels or that, you know, in say New York or the White House among the Americans who think that there is a path forward here. You know, the best case I can estimate is that Ukraine hangs on, you know, and they slowly lose land, you know, and that it's not dramatic and it takes another year and a half or whatever for the rest of Donetsk to be seized or something, you know, like that's the best case. And that is the best case, you know, and, you know, the failure of, I think, the West to understand the Russians' goals and objectives in this, that it was never about the conquest of all of Ukraine. Again, it was about Russia's now security interests as well as you know, as it changes in 2022, taking the four provinces or oblasts of eastern Ukraine, and that's it. I don't understand this idea of a pathway forward, where they think it's going to come from. The fact that it continues to be spoken about in a way that receives attention, that's, you know, entire conferences are centered around it. I just was reading about the IMF report from a month or so ago that details the state of the Ukrainian economy, the state of Ukrainian government finances. And again, they're going to be $70 billion short. That money has to come in or else they'll be, you know, they'll go bankrupt and everything will crash. And, you know, you looked at the estimation that IMF have been using for the last few years. Their estimates were all based upon the war ending this year. Their estimates, their economists were utilizing the information they received from their geopolitical peers who were advised by, retired military officers and strategists at places like the Institute for Study of War and the Atlantic Council and, you know, the Royal Uniformed Services Institute and so on and so forth, right? That the war would be over by 2025. By 2025, Ukraine would have won this war. So, I mean, and that's the analysis that informed the IMF's decisions on Ukrainian borrowing, right? That is the at the top level of the world monetary, economic, and financial order sits organizations like the IMF that make incredibly important decisions and then execute on those decisions based upon the fact that people like General Ben Hodges is saying the war is going to be over in 2025, or that Fred Kagan believes there is a pathway to win this war, that the Russians can't win on the ground or the Ukrainians can, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Their commentary has a much greater effect than simply causing our ears to bleed because they're repeating this nonsense nonstop on Fox or CNN or quoted in the Journal or whatever. It actually does inform really important decisions. So when the IMF says, okay, Ukraine only needs a $15 billion loan to get them through 2025 and then the war is going to be over, well, there we go. That then puts you in a position where, holy cow, we're wrong. And you know how institutions like this work. They won't admit that they're wrong until the very last moment.
Or even after the last moment.
Even after the worst moment. And so now the fact where like Ukraine's budget gap is, you know, this ugly, roaring, hell hole coming, you know, in the ground in front of you. Well, okay, now all of a sudden we need $70 billion. Where's it going to come from? And that's why you've seen in the last week or two this renewed calls from the Europeans. We're just going to take it from the frozen Russian assets. You know, that's illegal, but also, too, the Russians have plenty of Western assets. Do you want to go in a tit for tat that way then, you know? But now, of course, as well, but by 2027, Ukraine will win. And at that point, Russia will have to pay off all this loans. That's all things. So the Europe, people who aren't familiar, the European Union is moving forward and providing a $160 billion loan to Ukraine. This one, to show how mad the Europeans are, the commissioner, the European Commission, the budget director has said that this $160 billion loan won't count in the accounting stats towards European budget deficits, because the Russians will have to pay this money back in the future when they lose the war. So that's how mad
okay.
right now, right? Their head of budget for the EC is saying that we're not going to put this $160 billion on the ledger because Ukraine's going to win this war. And then as a result of their victory, the Russians are going to be forced to pay reparations, and then they will pay back this loan. That's the madness that we're dealing with here. That you can't even have people do sound accounting, that they're when it comes to like measuring the European overall health as well as individual nations' health, they're willing to just throw everything out the window because they're so blinded by the fever dream of defeating the Russians in war.
Well, that's you could die from that fever, by the way, if you don't get it solved pretty quickly. And certainly a lot of Ukrainians will die in all seriousness.
Yeah, exactly. And they are dying. And a lot of Russians are dying. And the expansion of this war, you opened with the escalation on the attacks on energy infrastructure. And I think this is proving the point made by those who say, you know what, the Ukraine-Russia war is eventually going to resemble the Iran-Iraq war, where there won't be a lot of movement on the ground and neither side can deal a knockout punch. I'm not really so sure about that with the Ukrainians right now because of the state of their manpower issues with their army and also their economic health. They may face collapse, but it's going to turn into, as the Iran-Iraq war turned into, while they still had terrible fighting on the front lines, it turned into what was called the War of the Cities, where they just launched missiles at one another's cities. And that's essentially what we're seeing developing in this war, both sides trying to hit each other in rear areas to try and bring about either have a negative impact on the country's ability to fight the war or put pressure on their citizenry. And to be fair, we've really not seen as much from the Russians as we could expect to see. The Russians really haven't hit civilian infrastructure. They've hit the energy infrastructure. They've hit some bridges, but not a lot of what we would call civilian infrastructure. Yeah. They've hit nothing. When you compare it to the Israelis, they've hit absolutely nothing. And the number of Ukrainian civilians killed, while still, as anyone would think, you know, rightly think, terrible, it's still a fraction of what we've seen in terms of casualties, say, of civilians in any of the Middle Eastern wars or any of the African wars. You know, in what happened was a month ago, you had that Ukrainian drone hit a government building in Kyiv. And that was the first time a Ukrainian government non-military building had been hit by the Russians. And even the mayor of Kyiv, Klitschko, you know, he said that it was an accident. The drone either got hit by something or got jammed and it crashed in the government building. So we've not even seen the Russians go after, right, the infrastructure.
And some people have been saying that a lot lately on the Russian side. They've been, that's one of the points of anger. Yeah. Listen, I'm sorry. I'm going to have to shift gears here pretty much, or we're going to run out of time. Before I leave this topic, though, there was one interesting video that came out of the White House this morning, not from President Trump, but from the First Lady.
Much has unfolded since President Putin received my letter last August. He responded in writing, signaling a willingness to engage with me directly and outlining details regarding the Ukrainian children residing in Russia. And since then, President Putin and I have had an open channel of communication regarding the welfare of these children. For the past 3 months, both sides have participated in several back-channel meetings and calls, all in good faith. We have agreed to cooperate with each other for the benefit of all people involved in this war. 8 children have been rejoined with their families during the past 24 hours.
It's kind of a good story. It's a nice story that they've been talking, because anything that's going to help move anything towards peace is good. 8 children allegedly came back, but the claim is that there is like 20 or 30,000 of them. And the Russians say, well, there actually aren't any for various reasons. I'm not sure where these 8 came from, but what do you make of that?
Yeah, I've had a great difficulty following this story for the last few years. Various estimates are put out there. I don't believe either side, you know, so it's kind of hard to take the word of the Russians or the Ukrainians on this. The consequences of war, you're going to have people separated. Whether it was a planned kidnapping and abduction of tens of thousands of children by the Russians, or was something less sinister, I don't really know. But I agree, though, with you, Danny, in a sense that any type of discussion, any type of deals, any type of action that has results, as Melania Trump is describing, is welcome, and it demonstrates that both sides can work together. I mean, and this has been the point made over and over again. You can talk to the Russians. You don't have to like them, but you can negotiate with them. We've seen dozens of prisoner of war exchanges. We the Black Sea grain deal, which ultimately has fallen apart. But, you know, that held, you know, for quite a while. Right. You know, I mean, like, and so in my reading of that is that it didn't fail. It wasn't the fall of the Russians that it failed. There are opportunities here that can be where good faith can be shown, where relationships can be established, and then those can be built upon to grow into negotiations. Particularly now, we're at this point where it seems that both sides are willing to walk away from negotiations. The comments from the Russian deputy foreign minister this week were very disappointing, understandable, but very disappointing.
Sergei Ryabkov said that he felt that all the momentum from Alaska had been played out and was gone. Right.
Yeah. And even today, you know, Vladimir Putin said about the New START treaty. He said, because he had offered a couple weeks ago now, hey, let's extend this New START, because New START, the arms control deal that keeps Russian and U.S. Warheads capped at about 1,500 each. That's set to expire in February. And, you know, the explosion, the arms race that's going to come from that, we're already in an arms race, but the explosion that's going to come from that is going to be massive. And Vladimir Putin a couple weeks ago said, let's extend it for another year.
Yeah.
And initially the White House said, that sounds like a good idea. But as far as we know, the Americans in 2 weeks' time have not responded at all to the Russians. And the Russian president just today said, if they want to, that's great. But if they don't want to extend it, no big deal. We're building new weapons, lots of new weapons, and we're going to be okay. I mean, so we're this is a terrible spot that where we may have had some very cautious hope, you know, several months ago. I think that's, you know, that's more or less going away.
Yeah, I think that's the case. And speaking of things that are going away, let's hope that one of them in the Middle East is not an opportunity for peace. I don't want to let you get away without discussing the events of today, because the ceasefire has finally gone into effect. The Israeli cabinet did sign off last night on this, actually the early morning hours today. And at least as of right now, the peace is holding, and there's a plan for President Trump to be in Jerusalem on Monday, where a lot of these hostages are supposed to come back. He's going to present a presentation before the Knesset to kind of take a victory lap, et cetera. But we need to see where are we really at? What are the chances of peace here? And let me start off the conversation here with something that Netanyahu said earlier today, where he was kind of doing his own victory lap. And if I can say charitably, has an interesting take on history.
I remind you that there were those who said at the beginning of the war, well, we need to get used to the idea that we won't be able to bring back even one hostage alive. Some would have faced out. I thought differently and acted differently. I believe that if we applied heavy military pressure on Hamas combined with heavy diplomatic pressure, we could indeed bring back all our captives.
And I think
that's
that's exactly what we've done. So he says, everybody said that there would be no hostages, not even one of them, he claimed, but because I put military pressure and diplomatic pressure, now finally we have it. I mean, even before I go any further, what do you say to that?
It's just such nonsense. It's just more lies. I'll just leave it at that. More lies. You know, I mean, like,
leave it at that. We're going to go with it a little bit further, because in the Israeli media today, in the Times of Israel, there was a spokesman for one of the political parties in Israel that is taking issue with this. This guy named Haim Rubinstein, who had previously served as a spokesman for the Israeli political party, met with Netanyahu and some of his officials on 26 October. So barely 2 weeks after the attack. To discuss hostage return on the part of the families. He said, we left the meeting very disappointed because Netanyahu talked about dismantling Hamas as the goal of the war. He didn't promise anything regarding demand of return of the hostages. He merely said a military operation in Gaza was needed to serve as leverage for the hostages' release. But, and this is the huge point, which I think needs to be broadcast everywhere, we later found out that Hamas had offered on October 9th or 10th, so 2 or 3 days after the war started, to release all the civilian hostages in exchange for the IDF not entering into the strip, but the government rejected the offer. That's one. So that's as of today. That was 2 or 3 days later. Then earlier this year, there was a deal that had been placed that Trump pressed to get a ceasefire to get hostages released. And part of that deal, a lot of people don't remember this today or may not have even known, as part of that first phase of that deal in January, Hamas and its allied militants group will release 33 hostages in the first phase. Following that, Hamas will release 3 Israeli detainees every 7 days, starting with women and children. During the 6th week, Hamas will release all remaining detainees. And so we had a chance, a second shot this year, that if Israel had merely let the ceasefire roll, they would have gotten all their hostages back, and many of whom, from what I understand, who were alive at that time aren't now. So some of the dead hostages would have been returned alive. So now that in light of Israeli media and what we now know from the deal earlier this year, I mean, it's just a flat-out bold-faced lie what Netanyahu's saying.
Right, and if you recall, go back almost 2 years to the first ceasefire in November of 2023, when hostages were exchanged on both sides, That was about a 5 or 6 day long ceasefire that could have been extended. And the Israelis did not want to extend it. The extension broke down over the classification of the Israelis. Essentially, the Israelis refused to allow Hamas to classify female soldiers as prisoners of war, as soldiers. That was essentially it. That was what broke down that initial 6 or 7 day long ceasefire in November of 23. Also in the last day or two, Danny, the Times of Israel has published leaked emails showing that on the first day of the war, on October 7th, when the Israelis didn't know how many had been taken hostage, but knew that it numbered into the hundreds, so not insignificant by any means, right? Not a minimal amount. You had Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister, Yoav Gallant, the defense minister, and Herzl Hesli, the former IDF chief of staff, all saying, forget about the hostages. Don't worry about them. Smotrich says, ignore the hostages. Either the defense minister or the chief of staff said along the lines of, like, we learned from Lebanon not to care about the hostages, that their hostages are not going to be an objective or a goal in our military operations. So on the first day, you had members of the cabinet saying clearly, we don't care about the hostages. And then Netanyahu's rewriting of history here. Because the times that Israel did get back the bulk, the vast majority of hostages were during the ceasefires, either the November 23 one or the January 2025 one. That's when the vast majority of hostages came back to Israel and to their families alive. The Israeli military did get some back. But the Israeli military killed many, many more. And that's one of the issues right now with this upcoming hostage exchange is whether or not the Palestinians can actually get all of and recover all of the hostage remains, because they may be in buildings that have 8 stories of rubble on top of them. These are places where when you talk about that, there are 48 hostages remaining. 22 are alive, the other 28 are dead. It's not certain how many of those who are dead are able to be recovered. This is a ugly thing. And then, of course, almost nothing is spoken about the Palestinian hostages, about those held in Israeli prisons, which number maybe as many as 15,000. And we know because it's been documented, at least 78 Palestinians have been killed in Israeli prisons since October 7th, 2023. Oh, wow. And many of them tortured to death. Many of them, there's a documentation that some were essentially raped to death using metal bars or iron bars. They were raped to death. I mean, the ghastliness of this, the horror of this, most people in the United States have no conception of. And this is all well documented. This is documented by the United Nations. It's documented by the major international human rights organizations. It's documented by Israel's own human rights organization, B'Tselem. The level of cruelty here carried out by the Israelis, their barbarity wasn't just on the quote battlefield unquote. It occurred when they had thousands, or as they have thousands of Palestinians in captivity. The torture is systematic. It's deliberate. It's a story that I think many people just aren't aware of. And certainly the media in the West doesn't cover it all. The implicit wording of Palestinian prisoners, and the fact that there's almost no discussion in Western media about who they are. Many of them are innocent people who are just abducted. Many of them are healthcare workers. There's 350 Palestinian healthcare workers that were abducted, detained, put into these torture prisons by the Israelis. 350 doctors, nurses, right? Paramedics. The way that the Western press phrases this situation is that they are prisoners, and that's all they say. And they imply that these are all terrorists. These are all people who committed some kind of crime. And even those who are actually in prison, in an Israeli prison, with a conviction against them, we have to remember that those convictions all came in Israeli military courts,
where there's no semblance of law. There's no due process. Those courts have like a 99.8% conviction rate. So, yeah, I mean, the tales here, and we'll see when the Palestinian prisoners are returned, as we've seen before.
I'm running really low on time here, and I want to look at one real quick last thing before I have to let you go, is where we go from here, because there are some history that we had where statesmen a lot better than we have here are not, didn't exactly succeed, but had a good chance. So in terms of where this is early start here is going to go, let's see where we have been before here. Back in 1978 is Jimmy Carter and Menachem Begin, and also the Egyptian leader.
There are still great difficulties that remain and many hard issues to be settled. The questions that have brought warfare and bitterness to the Middle East for the last 30 years will not be settled overnight. But we should all recognize the substantial achievements that have been made. One of the agreements that President Sadat and Prime Minister Begin are signing tonight is entitled A Framework for Peace in the Middle East.
Yeah, so much hope for then, or the Clinton Oslo Accords, or you know, any number of other things, and everything keeps falling apart. Where do we go from here?
Just have to wait and see what happens. I think most of us have a very healthy skepticism. You know, I wrote on my Substack what I think this will look like. It's incredibly cynical and very negative, but I have no reason to be anything other than that. I think at best case, if it holds, if this deal holds, you have an immiserated Palestinian population that doesn't have sovereignty, and at best they receive the scraps of the Trump reconstruction effort, the construction of the Trump Riviera in Gaza. That whatever falls off the table from that, that's what the Palestinians will be able to possess. I think that's the best case. And of course, certainly worst case is that you either have some type of foreign imposed occupation on the Palestinians in Gaza, or Israel just goes right back to their genocide and ethnic cleansing as they have done. The Israelis are more than happy to pick up where they left off or to start over again. And we're seeing pictures today, right? Video today of Palestinians heading back to the north of Gaza. We saw those same pictures last January. And if need be, the Israelis will just start over again and, you know, push people back south as they need to. So I think, you know, the best case is really an awful case, but it's the one that there's a possibility for it now. And so, as you said to me earlier, any day that the bombs aren't falling on the Palestinian people and that aid is getting in, we haven't seen the aid coming yet, but I know the UN and other organizations are preparing for that. Any day to stop seeing children being slaughtered by bombs or starved to death, well, I think most of us will take that.
Yeah, I will take every day. And just, you know, the hope is that a lot of it, because what's different now than before was that there is a lot more international pressure and a lot less, even within the U.S. administration's, the Trump supporters, even there's been a shift there against a lot of this, you know, this carnage that's been going on and ethnic cleansing, et cetera. So maybe that'll have some difference here. It remains to be seen, and we certainly hope that's the case. But in any case, we really appreciate you coming on today and providing us with such clarity really on both of these issues, both on the Russia-Ukraine situation, by just laying out the truth there, stark ways, and this situation here. So at least people are armed with the truth, and that's one of the things we'd love to bring about here and love to have you on. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Danny.
And we appreciate you guys, too. Be sure and like and subscribe if you haven't on your way out. And I look forward to seeing you on the next episode of the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.